Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Social Media Branded, hosted by me, Theo Brandsell. I'm an entrepreneur, author, speaker, and a social media expert. And today, I am blessed to have Alan Barnard. That's how you pronounce the name, your name, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Great. And I got introduced to Alan by Richard from London, and I believe that we have spoken on a couple of times before. But I don't really know that much about you. So could you just tell me super quickly what it is that you do?
Sure. So I have a research laboratory called Goldratt Research Laboratories. And we focus on decision making, specifically why good people make and often repeat bad decisions. And based on that research, both in people's personal lives, but also in business, based on that research, we then develop decision support methods. And from those methods, we develop decision support apps. So today we have a whole range of apps, and they're all targeted on just one single goal, which is helping people make better, faster decisions when it really matters. And the really matters part is important because we make thousands of decisions every day. Most of those are not important, but there are a few that are important that matters a lot. Getting those right or wrong could be the difference between success or failure. So that's what I'm currently doing. My background is I studied industrial engineering, then went and studied psychology, economics, finally did a master's and PhD in innovation and technology, and went into corporate, started in manufacturing, later went into large corporates, into breweries, but they were all focused on trying to learn both in a business and personal environment, what are the type of big decisions we face? Secondly, what are the avoidable mistakes we make that are consequential? Because many of the decision mistakes we make are not avoidable. But there are a few that are avoidable and consequential, and that became my focus. And then I started my own business, and from about 2009, I have a research laboratory. And the research laboratory typically partners with leading organizations, both private and public sector, to do the type of research that I just mentioned.
Okay, so it's all types of decisions when it comes
yes.
to
this. So a way of thinking about it is if you think about in a business, there's sort of three big types of decisions that we make: planning decisions, execution decisions, and improvement decisions. Planning decisions are all the decisions we make before we start doing the work, right? So for example, how am I going to allocate capital, or how will I allocate my scarcest resource, which is my limited attention? How will I allocate that scarce resource? How will I control the release of the work into the system? How do I decide when to do something and then what priority? These are execution decisions. And then the improvement side is, when do I make a change? So it turns out that there are very generic decisions we make, but also quite generic mistakes that we make in making those decisions. And what we do is we try to identify what are these big decisions, what's the common mistakes that we make, what's the principle that we can use to reduce that avoidable mistake, and then turn that into practical decision rules or decision support methods that we can then turn into apps and provide to both organizations as well as individuals.
Have you personally used this in your personal life?
Of course.
Or could
of
you
course.
Give me, so, and how long have you been doing this?
So I started being very curious about decision making when I was very young. You know, I looked around and I noticed something very curious, is that some people, despite having very, very limiting and challenging starting conditions. You know, they might have very poor parents or uneducated parents, or maybe some learning disability. Somehow these people, despite these difficulties, became very successful. And then others had almost ideal starting conditions, and it turned out that they didn't achieve the goals that they set out to do. And what I realized, it wasn't so much about the starting conditions that we face, but rather the starting assumptions that we have when we make those crucial decisions. So that's kind of what triggered me is, as a personal example, I was at school and We wrote this test, and soon they told us that they called us up and said, "Oh, you qualified for the school for gifted children." So myself and my best friend were selected for this. We were quite shocked. You know, we were average kids. We were, you know, all about, you know, playing outside, playing sports and games and stuff. And suddenly we ended up in the school for gifted children. And what was quite remarkable was almost immediately our results went up. And that to me was curious. So we overheard teachers and parents, you know, talk about this. Oh, maybe they were just not stimulated enough before, and now this new school is stimulating them enough. About 3 months later, this best friend of mine that was with me at the school was called into the principal's office, and he came back quite emotional. And he said to me that he's got terrible news. They told him that there was a mistake in his test and that he wasn't really gifted. And I thought, wow, that really sucks. I mean, even as a 10-year-old kid, you can realize, you know, that really sucks. Why would you tell a kid that they're not gifted after, you know, everything's going so well? And it almost immediately his marks started dropping. And that to me was curious. Is how can it be that if somebody tells you and you believe that you're gifted, you perform as if you were gifted and vice versa? And then a few years later, I went into high school. I wrote an entrance exam. It was a special high school I had to get into to go and study engineering, a technical high school. And I did really badly. And, you know, I by that stage, I was really doing well academically. And I argued with the teachers. They said, no, you know, you're not going to rewrite the exam. That's it. You're stuck in the D class. And the kids were teasing you, D for dummies, you know. And almost immediately, my results started dropping. And then I remembered what had happened a couple of years back. And that's sort of how I got interested in this very interesting relationship between success and failure, the decisions that we make when we are encountering events in our life that turns out to have a big impact on how successful we are or not. And then below those decisions, what are these assumptions that we use in order to make those decisions? And a big moment was when I read Henry Ford's quote, when he said, whether you believe you can do something or can't, you're right. And I thought, so that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I wanted to figure out how can I help somebody identify what are the assumptions or beliefs that they have that's not right or wrong, but are helpful or harmful, that could, you know, either enable them to achieve things that they thought might be impossible, or on the other side, could limit them, could block them from achieving things that were actually possible if they had just tried. And that's how I got into this field. So I've always been practicing it. All that happened over time is as I studied it, I started developing frameworks and systems to do it more reliably, more consistently. And that's what we now teach others, and also what's encapsulated inside of our apps.
Okay. That's a really fascinating story. I want to ask you a little bit about your personal life as well. And I want to start off by asking, what are the top three most important decisions that you've made in your personal life that have gotten you to where you are today?
Yeah, I think probably one of the first ones is, you know, when you arrive at at an event and you see somebody that you've always looked up to and admired, whether to have the courage to actually go up to them and speak to them. So that was one of the first big decisions that I realized. I read this book by somebody that became later my mentor and friend, Dr. Elie Goldratt. He was one of the top scientists in the world at that stage, and he had written this book called The Goal that had a very interesting idea. It said if you're trying to analyze or improve or manage overall systems, you know, you should just pay attention to the constraint of the system. Where is the constraint or the weakest link of the system? So I read this book, we implemented it, but I really wanted to meet this person. And I had an opportunity, went to a conference, and, you know, I was nervous as hell because he was this amazing character, right? I'm sure you've had that kind of experience. It's almost like, you know, going up to somebody to ask them to dance with you, you know? It's like you're nervous. What if they said no or they dismiss you? So that was a really big decision. And it turned out that was probably one of the most important decisions I ever made in my life, because this person more than anybody else probably on the planet, had a profound impact on my life. One of the things I've learned from him is not what to think, but how to think. So when you are facing a specific situation, either positive stress that you want to capitalize on, you know, some opportunity you were given, or some negative stress that you need to deal with or cope with, how do you go about making good, really good decisions? So that was probably the first big decision. You know, then the others are whether to go and start your own business. I've always been an entrepreneur since very young. I've always wanted to do my own thing. You know, we grew up without much resources, and that was, it sucks, of course, because you can't buy the stuff that you would really love. But it was great from a perspective that it taught me that if you want to make money, you have to go out there and make it. You know, one of the big lessons my grandfather taught me was you don't get what you wish for. You get what you work for. So I've always been an entrepreneur. So there was this big decision. The second big decision was, do I go after I graduated and immediately start my own company? Or first, do I join another company, a big corporate group? And I decided to go into corporate for the simple reason I knew I wasn't going to be a good fit, right? I'm not good at being managed by somebody else, but I can bite my tongue. But the reason I wanted to go there was I realized that that was going to ultimately be, you know, customers of ours, people that are in big organizations. And I needed to understand what are the pressures that they experience, what are the conditions that can cause them to make and often repeat decision mistakes. So I stayed there for a few years before I went and started my own company. And of course, then there's the personal decisions, which is, you know, should I get married or not? Should I have children or not? You know, what are the type of life that I want for myself? Is am I going to pick a life that's maybe, you know, easy and simple and, you know, take a corporate job and stay with it? Or am I going to go the very adventurous road of starting my own business and living with all the stresses and strains, but every morning being able to wake up with that feeling that I'm doing what I love doing? So those are three big decisions, I think, that that I've faced in my life, and thank goodness I made the right choices at the right time.
Yeah. So essentially, is what you teach and what you do, and with your business, is it just that it is a structure or a system that you go through? So first I ask question A, and if I get A and B, A or B, I take this road. And then I ask another question, and then depending on the answers that you get from all the questions you ask, you make a decision from it.
Yes, there's a kind of a motto that I think encapsulates this insight, which is the best solutions always starts with the right questions. Right, so if you know what question to ask, especially when it comes to helping somebody expose a limiting assumption or belief, that's the most powerful thing. So rather than, you know, spending maybe 5 years with a psychologist or even a psychiatrist to find out what these limiting assumptions or beliefs are, it turns out that many of those we can expose ourselves or discover ourselves just by asking a very simple question. So I'll give an example. One of the most common decision mistakes we make, I mentioned to you, is how we allocate our scarcest resources, right? So one of the most common things we do as a mistake, both in our personal life as well as in organizations, is we do things that are not important, that in terms of achieving our goal is not going to help us meaningfully make progress towards achieving our goal. But it occupies our time and attention and often our budget, right? So when you're doing something and you ask yourself a simple question, number one, how will this really help? So think about your goal and how is what I'm currently doing, or even who I'm currently with, how will this help me meaningfully make progress towards the goal? Because there's a scarce resource, my limited attention. I have to decide how to allocate it. And the second question, which is, even if I can convince myself or maybe others that this can help me achieve my goal, what am I giving up by doing this thing? So that's the opportunity cost, right? So what else am I not doing that I could have been doing that maybe could have helped me make even more meaningful progress? So those are two simple questions that we've developed to help you prevent this common mistake that we all make, which is we end up doing a lot of stuff, stressing a lot of stuff that actually won't matter or that we can't do anything about. And that's sort of a practical way. So in the app that we've built, guess what's the first question that you're going to be asked, right? Is what's this issue that you're currently facing, either a problem or opportunity? Explain why you think this is important to you to do and to those that you care about. And once you've written those answers, the app then pauses you, slows down your thinking, and highlights to those two boxes that you've just completed and said, have a look at what you've written there. Is it really important enough that you stop procrastinating and actually dealing with this issue right now? Or it's actually not that important. Find something else to invest your time and attention on.
So it's so for example, for when doing it's essentially a tool that helps people self-reflect.
Yes, but not just self-reflect. So there's kind of three steps that we talk about. The first one is just better understanding this issue that I'm facing, right? The problem I'm dealing with, the conflict that I have in terms of which options to go for, what can cause me to maybe overreact or underreact. That's all about understanding my situation better. And that's definitely reflecting on what I'm facing at the moment. But there's a second portion, which is, what are the best options to consider to deal with this thing? Because I have the two options that I'm considering now, maybe make a change, like, you know, quit my job, don't quit my job. So there's two options. Each of them have got their own unique upsides and downsides. But are there other options that I'm not aware of? So in that second part, what we've discovered is, what are the questions to ask you to help you discover better options? And by better, I simply mean an option that has a big upside if it works and a small downside if it doesn't, right? Or at least avoid those options that have a small upside if it really works and a huge downside if it doesn't. So that's the second part, is to discover new options that I previously didn't consider. And then the third part is that almost every time we make a breakthrough in anything that we're passionate about, you know, you'll feel compelled to start thinking about it, to start sharing it with people. And normally you get the opposite response of what you're hoping for, which is, oh my God, you're an amazing person. How did you come up with this? Normally you get this thing of, yes, but, right? Yes, I like the idea, but, and then there's a whole range of buts. But this thing is not going to be a win for everyone. But it might have some negatives. But there's some obstacles that you don't think about. So rather than ignoring those yes, buts, what we then do is we help you to actually ask for them. So can you think of any reason why this wouldn't work? But every time you give me a yes, but, you have to give me a yes and, right? What can I add to my idea to overcome this yes, but that you've just shared with me? And that makes this solution even more robust. It's sort of turning something from a half-baked idea into a fully baked idea. And that's something that we can do inside of the app.
Okay. Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. And you found a way to automate all of this.
Yes, so typically what we do in our research is we typically partner with a large organization, private or public sector. They give us some kind of wicked problem to investigate. And then we work with them and we first of all see if the current method that we've developed can work there. If not, what changes or enhancements to make. We then try it out to pick a new case and see if it works there. Try it for another case. And after some time, we feel, wow, we are confident that this approach, this method that we've developed to help somebody make a better, faster decision or to really resolve a problem in a much better way is really robust. And once that's true, then we turn that knowledge into an app. And that's what can give us scalability.
Okay. Yeah. So it's this is for a lot of people who want to make really big decisions or want to make a lot of decisions and want to make it a lot faster. And I saw that you work with a lot of businesses, for example, Google, Intel, ABB, and a lot of other major corporations around the world. But yeah, I see you want to say something.
Yeah, so just as a quick summary of over the years, essentially what we've discovered is that there's three main types of decision mistakes that we make that are avoidable. The first one is we don't realize to what extent our strong emotions can cause us to overreact and underreact. So we've created an app for that to help us to discover and expose those exaggerated fears of loss or effort or risk that can cause us to procrastinate on the one side, or those exaggerated frustrations with the status quo or the exaggerated expectations that can cause us to overreact. So we've created a method and an app for that. It's called the Procon Cloud Method and the Harmony Decision Maker app. That's the first one. The second one is where we realize that, especially in organizations where you have very ambitious goals to achieve, it could also be in your personal life. So we use this, for example, with high performance athletes. There's a really ambitious goal that they have to achieve, and they realize that there's a lot of changes that they have to make in order to realize that. And we then become overwhelmed. We don't even know where to start, so we often procrastinate. So what we created there is a simple method to help you figure out what are the fewest possible changes you have to make that will both be necessary and sufficient to achieve that goal, and secondly, in what sequence to make them, how to plan them, how to monitor the execution, and how to make course corrections. So how to sort of achieve the focus and fast feedback that you need. And there we've created an app called Harmony Changemaker. And that's specifically focused on that mistake where we often get overwhelmed with the number of changes we have to make and we don't even know where to start. But then there's a third one, which is when we're making a change, we need some way of predicting what the impact of the change is. And when we're dealing with complex systems, that can often be really, really difficult, as to figure out what the impact of the change is, or if we see a change in reality, to figure out what caused it. I'll give you a simple example. Imagine you have a business that's doing $100,000 in sales, or maybe $100 million, and your net profit is 5, right? So 5% is your net profit. And the next month's report shows that your profit has gone up by 20%. And now you're trying to figure out what the hell happened. So in your mind, a 20% increase in profit is quite a big impact, right? So we would typically look for some kind of big thing that has happened. It turns out that the thing that caused that 20% increase in net profit was an increase in the average selling price of just 1%. So if you think about that 100, if you can increase the average selling price by just 1%, by say reducing your discount, right? Your sales would have gone from 100 to 101. That one would fall directly to the bottom line because your cost doesn't go up if you can increase the average selling price. So your profit would have gone from 5 to 6, which is a 20% increase. So these type of problems, we really struggle. We struggle when small things can have a big impact, both in terms of looking backwards in time to try and explain what caused something, but also going forwards in time to say, I'm planning to make this change in my sales technique. How can I predict what will happen? Or I'm going to allocate my resources. I'm going to send less of the new product that I've just launched immediately out to all the stores. I'm going to hold it back in a distribution center and only replenish based on actual demand. Those are all things that we really struggle in our mind to be able to predict. The good news is that today's technology allows us to build essentially digital twins of very complex systems, so advanced simulation models that will allow us to answer those questions. So the third type of apps that we've developed is a range of digital twins. It's almost as a good analogy as, imagine the two of us want to build a driverless car, right? And we lock the door, and I say to you, Theo, what should be the rules for driving a car? Let's write them all down, and we program them into this computer, right? That is going to be controlling this driverless car. The problem is that we don't know how these rules will respond to every stressful situation. Maybe a little kid driving, running in front of a car, or we approach an intersection and a traffic light, which normally is easy to see, there's the sunlight shining on top of it, and it's very hard to detect. How will our rules deal with those type of situations? We don't know. So we're not going to take the risk of putting those rules into a real car and driving it on the public roads and hoping for the best. We're going to build a simulation model of that car with these rules. We'll stress test the hell out of it and then see how the rules react. And if we need to make modifications, we can do that. And that's essentially the third type of apps that we build, is these digital twins that will allow people to see the impact of changes or to test any theories first in a virtual environment, which is a very low cost, low risk environment, before they go and do it live. So for example, with Microsoft, we built a complete digital twin of their global supply chain to see what the impact will be if they managed inventories in that supply chain a little bit differently. The problem that they were experiencing was there was shortages and surpluses, you know, too much of one product and too little of another. And then they either lose sales or they stuck with a lot of inventory. And we could test all these rules in a virtual model before we actually help them to implement those into the real world. And the results were astounding. We had this amazing testimonial from their CTO saying in a financial year that we started, they reduced their inventories by over $250 million, and sales were up by a few hundred million. But you know, we wouldn't have felt confident to recommend doing that unless we had validated it first in a virtual environment.
Okay, yeah. So essentially, every time when you have made a prediction of what decisions or what changes will happen, you test it and you stress test it.
Exactly. I mean, the advances in technology is pretty astounding. So you remember in the old days when the king had somebody that whenever they ate something, this poor person had to eat it first to see what happens to them, right? Now imagine you could build a digital twin of you, right? Like literally you, whose biology would react in exactly the same way as you did, right? And you are given this piece of cheesecake, right? And you're wondering, should I eat this piece of cheesecake? Because what we do, one of the mistakes that we make is we replace the long-term impact for the short-term impact, right? So our decision-making is mainly informed by how I will feel when I'm going to have this piece of cheesecake, right? The endorphins will be released, I'll feel great, but then afterwards I'll feel guilty and maybe I'll suffer the consequences later on. So imagine you had a complete digital twin and you could literally say, show me the 10-year or 20-year impact of having this piece of cheesecake. You know, that could maybe change your mind whether you do something or not, right? So that's kind of where the technology is going. It's becoming very advanced. You know, we are a little bit away in terms of being able to accurately model all the complex systems within the human being. But in terms of physical machines and supply chains, we are there already. We can build remarkably accurate models, not just of pieces of equipment, but of whole networks or supply chains, to be able to help the human mind to see what will be the long-term or system-wide impact of a change. Like, for example, I can say, you know, I'm going to take this phone, maybe I buy a million of them if I'm a retail company, and I pay $500 if I buy it locally. Or I can save, you know, $100 if I buy it from some far foreign place that manufactures it, right? So my decision making is, wow, I buy a million, it's going to save me $100 each. That's $100 million that I will reduce my cost by. But that's thinking that the local impact is a good indication of the system-wide impact. And often it isn't. I need to go and check how much more inventory will I have to carry, because I'm now placing orders that maybe takes 4 months to get to me, or maybe 6 months. I'll have to pay cash up front. What if I have a quality issue and I'm stuck with all the stock? What if there's changes in models, right? And those are all things that the human mind can't comprehend, but in a simulation model, we can press the play button and see what will happen and see if we should apply a different strategy. So that's a really exciting part of what we are doing. So we both deal with human decision making that involves, you know, mistakes due to our strong emotions that cause us to over or underreact, but also using technology to enhance our own capabilities, where our capabilities have got some substantial limitations. And when you're asking people to make those type of decisions without giving them the technology to support it, they'll make bad decisions. And those bad decisions will end up in them having too much of a certain product or too little of that product.
Yeah. Have you run into a situation where you wanted to do something, but you weren't really able to figure out a way to do it? For example, build a simulation or figure out a way to make a certain decision. Are there certain limitations for doing this with technology?
Yes, I mean, fun-wise, you know, why sometimes people react so irrationally, that is, you know, a big mystery. But we are constantly learning about what are the type of things that can cause people to behave irrationally, right? There's a great book that was written by Dr. Dan Ariely, who's also with at Duke University, he lectures from Duke, and it's called Predictably Irrational. So, you know, it's kind of people are not rational, but they are predictably irrational. And those are the type of things that we are constantly considering and discovering, right? I'll give you a simple example. So at one stage, we were very curious about relationships. Why, despite the fact that today, before you get married, you can get a lot more information about the person, right? People generally take longer before they get married, right? So you know more about them. You take longer before you get married. And you also have some experience in terms of maybe your parents got a divorce or an uncle or aunt. So you know how kind of traumatic it is. Why, despite all that new knowledge, has the divorce rate not substantially improved? And we were curious about why this is, right? And we started studying this and realized that there are some of these things that are related to a relationship that makes relationships fragile by nature. So when you are harmed more by a negative stress than what you benefit from a positive stress, those negative stresses over time will accumulate. They won't cancel each other out. And as a result, rather than the relationship becoming stronger and stronger, it actually becomes weaker and weaker. So that's a kind of an interesting discovery that we made about why relationships by definition is fragile. The only ones that are the opposite of fragile, which is not robust, but anti-fragile, so they get stronger over time, the more you stress them, are ones where the couple have figured out a mechanism to reduce the damage that negative stresses have on their relationship. And we all will have those, right? You'll get into arguments, somebody will do something stupid, say something stupid. And the question is, okay, how do I deal with those? I need to think about that and agree with my partner when something bad is going to happen. How do we limit the harm of that on our relationship? At the same time, we need a mechanism to fully appreciate all the successes, right? So when you get blamed for all the negative stresses, but you don't get credit for any of the positives, you can imagine the thing is not going to last for a long time. So that's kind of a very interesting one. Another one that we found out is, so we had an interview with this woman, very successful businesswoman. And I said, what happened? She said, no, she got a divorce. I said, what happened? She said, well, she, you know, was out on a conference and, you know, she was just going through a little bit of a bad emotional patch and she felt underappreciated. One thing led to another after a few glasses of red wine and she had this one night stand with this guy right at the conference. And she realized almost immediately this was the biggest mistake in her whole life, right? It will devastate the husband and the kids. And I said, so what did you do? I assumed that you just kept quiet. She said, no, I was so worried that my husband will find out that I told him. I said, okay, I'm struggling to understand the rationale. Right? So you've gone from something where there's a small chance that they might find out to 100% chance, and somehow you thought that this is better, right? And that's when, you know, going back to those strong emotions, is that sometimes these strong emotions can result in us making a really bad decision, and we have to live with the consequences, you know? So it's easy when you sort of take these things and you start analyzing, are the mistakes that we make, are they avoidable or not? You know, an unavoidable one would be, you get into a relationship, whether it's a romantic or business relationship with somebody, you've done all your research, and then it turns out that they, you know, they're dishonest, right? And they do something stupid that really harms the business. Now, can you go back and say, could you have predicted that? Often you can't, you know, based on the body language, based on the prior knowledge, that is to me like an unavoidable mistake. But there are ones that are avoidable, and those are the ones that we want to focus on, not just whether they're avoidable or not, but if they were consequential, you know, getting those right or wrong, that would make a big difference.
So it's really psychology that you and your group of people are focused on, and then you just find a way to translate it and automate it with the help of technology.
Yeah, I think it combines three fields, and that's kind of what I did, right? So the first part is the engineering and science part. It's really understanding how do you analyze and improve stuff, right? That's what engineering and science teaches you, is that there's a method that you could use to systematically analyze anything that you're passionate about and figure out a way to do it better, faster, simpler, cheaper, right? So that to me was a really sort of a foundational knowledge that I needed. But then, of course, almost all the systems that we're dealing with are social systems. The things that make them complex is that there are these little agents called human beings, and human beings often make decisions that are not perfectly aligned with what's good for the overall system, but more what's good for them, right? And so unless you have some foundational understanding of psychology, you're really going to struggle. And then the other part is economics, right? Is at the biggest scheme of things is how do people respond to incentives, positive and negative incentives? And I think even today, if you think about somebody like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, as the reason why they've become so successful is because they had knowledge about these three elements, right? If you are building any form of app, you need to understand what problem this app is solving and how to engineer a solution to actually solve that problem, right? You need to understand the psychology about what will it take to get somebody to even download your app and then use it on an ongoing basis. And then the last part is you need to understand the economics, because you can do the first two and get gazillion downloads, but then you're not making money. So unless you have that economics part to that, and that's kind of what my almost natural area was, is I wanted to know these three elements in order to do something that is hopefully valuable in the future.
Okay, so, okay. So I know this is technically a marketing and branding and sales show, but yes. Because this is your main focus, and I really enjoy talking to you about this, I want to continue our discussion about more personal things.
Sure, I can just give you one example that hopefully will resonate with your listeners in terms of marketing and branding, right? I mentioned to you that one of our earliest insights when we were studying was that the scarcest resource we have, if somebody said to you, where's your bottleneck? What is it that you don't have enough of, you know, in order to achieve the goals that you've set for yourself? You could say, well, it could be information, or it could be money, or it could be connections. You know, there's many things that you could say, I don't have enough of this. But it turns out that our scarcest resource is our limited attention. So what and who we pay attention to makes all the difference. And you can do a sort of a quick experiment just in your mind to say, think about all the things that demand your attention or could benefit from your attention every day, right? And sort of draw a bar as how much is that? And then draw next to it another bar representing what your available attention is, right? And attention is even scarcer than time. Sort of attention, you know, we have 24 hours a day, but we don't have 24 hours of attention every day. Attention is essentially that undistracted time that we have that we can decide what to allocate it to make meaningful progress towards our goal. So once you realize that the scarcest resource for everybody is attention, then from a branding and marketing perspective, the question becomes, how do I get somebody to pay attention to me, to our company, to our products, right? And that requires quite a deep understanding of human psychology, is what will attract people's attention? And once I have their attention, how do I capitalize on it, right? So you see a lot of the things that some of the amazing work that companies like ClickFunnels do, you know, with Russell Brunson, who founded ClickFunnels, it's all about figuring this stuff out, right? Is how do I get somebody to pay attention to me? I need to increase the awareness that there is even an app, for example, in our case, for making decisions, right? So once somebody knows, oh, there's an app to do that, how do I get them curious enough that they're willing to download the app, right? But most apps people download, they never even open because they see something and they go, oh, that's interesting. So they quickly download the app, but they never go back to it. So now how do I get them to actually open up the app and try it out? And many apps, it's like a game, right? It's going to require some investment of your attention to figure out how this thing works and how to benefit from it or get value from it. How do I maintain their attention during that period? Because the mind is constantly looking for reasons to give up, right? To be distracted. So that to me is kind of the link between what we're doing. And I think what your talk show is all about is marketing, branding, sales for me is all about one thing. Is how to get the consumers out there, people that could potentially benefit from our products or services, how do I get them to pay attention to us? And once they've paid attention, how do I capitalize on that to get them to use the product and to use more of the product? And once I've got that, is how do I get more people to pay more or buy more of our products or services?
Yeah. And as you said in the beginning of that, you said people need a deep understanding of the psychology of the buyer. There are a lot of ways to market, but if you have a deep understanding about your customers or your clients or potential prospects, you can use the correct platform, for example, with social media marketing. On Facebook, you can put in interest of the people that you want to market to. So for example, if people want to learn more about decision making, you could put in interest of making decisions, for example. But then, as you said, to get their attention, how do you do that?
Yeah. So one of the lessons that I've learned that I can share with you is that, you know, imagine you're creating an app like what we have that can help people to make better decisions, right? What's the size of the market? It's almost 8 billion people. Because everybody that's, you know, mature enough that they have to start making their own decisions could benefit from being able to better understand why they could overreact and underreact to help them discover better options and make those options more robust. But you can't understand 8 billion people, right? So how do I market to that? So we tried, you know, you send out this marketing, which is quite generalized. Do you want to make better, faster decisions when it really matters? If yes, click on this button. And then almost nobody clicks because you're not targeting, right? So this idea of finding that specific niche, you know, what they call your dream 100 customers, right? And to be as specific as possible, to give it them even an avatar, give them a name, you know, what are their desires, what's their fears? And the more accurately you can describe those, the easier your branding and marketing and sales becomes. The more vague those are, the harder the challenge. So that was one of the big lessons that we've learned, is that you cannot do these things in general terms. You have to say, okay, I'm going to go after a specific market, which is high school kids that are facing a decision of which college to go to. And they've been procrastinating for some time, and it's starting to worry them. You know, what if I run out of time? What if I don't apply to my favorite college? I don't get in, or what if I get stuck? And what we realize is that's a way of making that marketing very precise, because then you can directly address their desires and fears in your marketing message and show them how they can use your app, which can be used for any type of decision, but specifically how to make that type of decision and how it can help you to avoid some of the mistakes that people generally make when they have to make that type of decision.
Yeah, and this is what usually people mean when they say you can't, even though your product or service may apply to everyone, you can't say, hey everyone, this is our product. You need to go specifically, hey everyone that's named Alan is 47 years old and lives in South Africa. That becomes specific, and it also gets people's attention. So it's really...
And sometimes it also means that you have to say for who this is not, right?
Yeah.
So I'm only speaking to you. I'm not speaking to you. I'm only speaking to you. And there's this anxiety, you know, why would you not be speaking to try and get as many customers as possible? But it's I think it's this part of it, of course, is the psychology of scarcity, right? But there's also a thing about the more specific I am, the better I can tailor my message and the less knowledge I need to have, right? Because it can be quite overwhelming to understand human psychology compared to saying, you know, I'm targeting this market. All I need to figure out is what where do I give their attention to? What do I pay attention to? You know, and how do I get some of that attention? And then once I've got that, you know, to capitalize on that, I think one of the biggest lessons I learned was quite a few years ago, one of our apps, this Harmony Decision Maker, was nominated for Silicon Valley Business App Awards. And I went to this amazing award ceremony in Santa Monica, you know, almost felt like the Oscars. And you're sitting down with all the top app developers in the world. And I was probably by far the oldest guy in the room. You know, that was the first awakening, which sucked. But what was amazing to me, what I learned from some of these very young developers, is that they realized very early on, almost intuitively, they don't have to go to college to learn this, they discovered this, is that when you're developing, especially an app, there's really two phases to it. The first phase is completely focus your own attention and that of your small team and the little bit of budget that you've got on what will it take to get a lot of people to use your app. That has to be number one priority. Once you've got a lot of people using the app, then you switch over to phase two, which is, how do I make money from that? What I realized I was doing is I was trying to do these two things simultaneously. And then you're constantly flip-flopping between them, right? So and how do these kids do it? As you know, right? They lock themselves in their parents' garage. They don't take a salary, you know, they hope that their parents will, you know, give them enough support to at least so they don't starve. But that's basically how they succeed. Whereas the more formal way is you do all this analysis, you come up with your business model, and you try to become profitable almost overnight before you've even been able to test the hypothesis that by doing this, it will be valuable to my target market. And whatever small niche that I pick in the global sense, you know, it's huge, right? Yeah. Doesn't matter how specific I get, there will be millions of those types of people around the world. So that to me was a really big lesson, is is really focus, and that's what we've been doing now, is to really focus on some niches. How do we get a lot of those people to download the app, to start using the app? Once they've done that, and that's why our app is for free at the moment, once we've done that, then we sure that there must be a way of monetizing it. But we'll think about that at a later stage.
Okay, yeah. That's basically the process of how you not only market things, but that's what you do. So you start with how you're going to market it, essentially. How will I get this to people?
I think that the step zero that I kind of skipped out of, which is, I think in hindsight is always obvious, but not when you start, is you have to pick an area that you're really passionate about, right? Something that you have some intuition about, and start with that. And the reason for it is, I think that there's a very good economic reason for that. Is if you think about it, there are always many, 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 many more ways to fail than to succeed. Right? Regardless of what you do, if you think about a simple recipe of baking a cake, you know, 4 steps, 4 ingredients, 2 temperature settings, there are many ways to get it wrong. There's few ways to get it right. So you better pick something that you are really passionate about, because else the first time your first prototype fails, you're going to quit, right? It almost needs to be like, I can't quit on this goal. I'm going to keep on going. So I think that's always the first step, is pick something that you're very passionate about, that you have some interest and intuition about, and then really go after that.
Yeah, and this is not just for people like yourself who are app developers, but this goes for everyone.
I think for any business, people say you have to do things that you're passionate about, but there's a very practical reason, is that it requires a huge amount of energy, right? And unless you're doing something that you're not absolutely passionate about, it becomes really, really hard to keep yourself motivated, especially considering the fact that most people will fail and keep on failing for many years before they succeed. And even then, you could be doing this for many years, the probability of success is still pretty small. So you better pick something that you're passionate about.
Yeah, and I 100% agree. So I want to shift focus a little bit to basically who people pay attention to or have respect for people's opinion. So for example, if I have a decision, a really important decision I want to make, and I, yes, for example, ask someone for advice, have you studied these psychology of who people listen to and why listen to certain people and some people? No.
One of the giants in the field of decision making, on whose shoulders I've tried to stand, because that's kind of the process in science, right? You stand on the shoulders of giants, right? The fact that Newton, that was his quote. The fact that I could see so far was because I stood on the shoulders of giants. So one for me of the giants in the field is Daniel Kahneman. He's a Nobel Prize winner. He wrote the book Thinking Fast and Slow. And he had a beautiful advice that he gives people. He says, look, when you're facing a decision that's really difficult to make, many things that you have to consider, and it's important, right? Getting it right or wrong really will make a difference. We often naturally ask other people for their advice. The problem with that is we don't realize that the way that we pick people is we pick people that have a high probability of agreeing with us.
Or disagreeing.
We don't. No, agreeing with us. We tend to pick people that we think will agree with us. And the reason for that is, from a psychological perspective, I don't want to challenge my assumptions or beliefs, because it's very disruptive and very stressful. So I make a decision, and now I'm going to pick, I know Theo will like my decision. So I go, Theo, I've got this decision I'm facing. I'm going to do this. And then I'm telling you all the positives of that, right? and the negatives of not doing it, or I can go for the other way. What do you think? And you trying to be a good friend, say, no, I absolutely agree with you. You know, you should quit your job and go for this, you know, network marketing opportunity. It sounds fantastic, right? So Daniel Kahneman, what his advice is knowing that this is a common human flaw, is that we actually make a decision and then we try to rationalize it. And part of that rationalization is we seek out people that we think subconsciously will agree with us with a decision we've already made, that we're just looking for some validation. So what he says is, here's the advice. When you're asking for advice, make sure that the person that you're asking advice for satisfies three criteria. First criteria is that they have intuition about the field that you're asking them, you know? And you build intuition by doing stuff, right? You become a master at something by doing 10,000 hours worth of work, right? So don't go and speak to somebody that's never had the thing or are new to it. Go and speak to somebody that's actually built up the intuition to make those type of tough decisions. That's number one. Second criteria is make sure you pick somebody that likes you, right? And the third criteria is that doesn't like you so much that they won't be brutally honest with you.
Yeah.
So that's my advice as well. I think those are great criteria. Pick somebody that actually knows what the hell they're talking about, right? Make sure that they like you, because else they might give you advice to harm you. But make sure that they don't like you so much that they won't be brutally honest with you. And often, you know, you have to tell them. So when I ask for advice, I always back it up and say, I need you to be brutally honest with me, right? We all have blind spots. What am I missing here? This is what I think I should be doing. What am I missing? What's your view? Be brutally honest. You know, it's a sign of disrespect for me as a scientist if you're not brutally honest, if you sugarcoat things or you agree with me, right? I want you to be brutally honest. And then you've got a much higher chance of getting good advice.
Yeah. And I kind of realized this the first time a few years back when me and my family were discussing what we were going to have for dinner. And I was thinking, should I ask them, what do you feel like eating? Or should I ask them, should we have pizza? So basically that goes to, it doesn't really fit into, but basically how you formulate the question. And depending on the question, we usually ask questions, as you said, that we want people to agree with. Usually.
Yes. And we often include it in our language, right? I think I should do this. Do you agree? And most people want to avoid conflict. You know, they want to avoid this the uncomfortable discussion. So they will generally say, yes, I agree with you. It takes a lot of courage, especially for people that you care about, to say, actually, I disagree completely. And here's why. Because now it can hurt the relationship, and you know, so you have to pick very wisely who do you seek out to help you check, you know, your thinking about really important decisions.
Yeah. Have you talked to someone, or have you studied people who make decisions not based on what other people think, but that, how should I put this, that have a relationship with God, or that have a relationship with subconscious, and they ask for advice from there? Yeah. Have you studied that or anything?
Look, I'm a scientist.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's normally very good explanations for all of these things. So it's not something I can comment on if you really think it's helpful to pray and ask. But just be aware that often, you know, we are prone to errors. So it's the same thing, right? Just I can easily convince myself. So I can have a discussion with you and walk away and say, wow, he fully supports me, right? I can even say that I heard him say that he fully supports me. And it might be something that you never said that, but I'm looking for validation. So I think it's whoever you reach out to, whether it's a person or, you know, your God, you have to be careful about the common mistakes that we all make, right? So that's something I can't really comment on. It's personally, you know, I want to think through things myself. I want to ask people that I know have got the intuition and experiences, because often when we follow our gut feel, we can make really bad decisions. And it's very difficult to say, how do I know, right? How do I know that God really spoke to me about this?
Yeah. I have one last question, and then I'm going to let you go, which is a question that I ask everyone, which is, do you have happiness, and how do you get it?
Yeah, I think it's an important thing. It's about being able to define what it means to you, right? So I think it's the same thing about, you know, to have a full and meaningful life. That to me is what the goal is, right? Is to have a full and meaningful life. And how I've turned that into a practical system almost is to say, what do I want to help people do? And for me, it's about helping people make better, faster decisions when it really matters. And for me to have a full and meaningful life means I'm making meaningful progress on that life goal, right? Of course, we are complex people, so we have multiple objectives. You know, you want to be healthy, wealthy, happy. And what I've realized quite early on in my life is pick one of those that, if you make progress on it, will also positively impact the others. So what I've realized personally is that I picked a goal that I love doing, that I'm very passionate about doing. And because I've selected a goal that I'm so passionate about, it definitely positively contributes to both my physical and mental health. And if I do a good job and I solve an important enough problem for enough people, I will be paid for it, right? So that's sort of pick one that, if you make progress on it, should help the others.
Okay, so what would you say? You would say that having a purpose gives you happiness.
I think having a purpose is a necessary condition for happiness, right? It gives you focus, and that's something that we all need. And I think the one thing that is often helpful is to think about, if you have to achieve multiple objectives, which are those is really the goal that you're trying to achieve, and which are necessary conditions. A necessary condition is something that you can have too little of, but also too much. So what is the level of enough? So if you think about, like, you want to be in a relationship, okay? That's not your goal in life, but it's kind of a necessary condition, right? You want to be in a happy relationship. And as soon as you say, okay, it's not a goal, but a necessary condition, you have to say, what's enough? What's enough time? Not too little, but also not too much. And then spend the time with your partner to say, this is kind of my idea of what's enough. If I spend too little, I know it's going to cause arguments between us, and that's going to distract me from reaching my goal. But also, if I spend too much time on it. And I think the same with health, right? Is how much is enough exercise? I mean, I can go and exercise 8 hours a day, but that means I have 8 hours less a day to make meaningful progress towards my goal. So as soon as I say that health is a necessary condition to help me at least to the level of good enough, then I can say, okay, what does that look like? What is definitely too little, but also what is too much? And make sure that I stay in that zone.
Okay. One of the reasons why I ask is to basically confirm my own philosophy or my own theory about happiness. Because you are a scientist and also a psychologist, but you study psychology, I wanted to check what you believe, what you think of
my. So what is your theory about happiness?
So the first thing people get wrong is that having happiness and being happy is not the same thing. you are happy, and you are happy when you experience joy and you do something that makes you happy. For example, for me, it's watching movies, being with friends, listening to music, and that kind of stuff. That makes me happy and that makes me experience joy. But another thing that also I need to have happiness is I need purpose, and I need a meaning to why I live. So joy and purpose. But I also need to be grateful for what I have. Because if I don't, I'm not grateful for what I have already, then you said, as you said, I won't know when I have enough. So right. Being grateful for what I have basically puts a limit to, okay, well, I have enough. And then the fourth thing I believe is don't do things you don't want to do. And that essentially means if you don't want to work in the factory, don't work in the factory. Of course, we all have to do small things sometimes that we don't want to do, paperwork, law stuff, and that kind of things. But doing things you don't want to do is also a corner pillar of happiness. So I would say that joy, purpose, being grateful, and not doing what you don't want to do is the four corner pillars or four cornerstones of happiness.
Yeah, I think on the last one, I agree with you. Look, there's many things that we have to do that we don't want to do, right? And for me, happiness is about understanding what those are, things that I have to do that I don't want to do, that's not helping me, and systematically finding ways to stop doing that or to get other people to do that for me. So that what I'm left with is mostly the things that I really have to do in terms of achieving my own goal, rather than have to do because somebody else tells me I should do it.
Yeah. And I've been debating whether I should say passion instead of doing things you don't want to do. But I don't feel like I can do that simply because we have to do sometimes things that we don't want to do.
Yeah, I think you have to be careful because how do I define something that I want to do, right? Want can mean two things. It's want because, you know, endorphins are released. You know, I eat a piece of cheesecake. It makes me feel instantly good at that moment, but it doesn't really help me achieve my long-term goal. So when I can align the things that I want to do to the things that I have to do to achieve my goal, that to me is perfect harmony, right? When there's a misalignment between the things I want to do and the things I have to do to make progress to my goal, that's when we get into trouble.
But what would you say about this theory? Would you say?
I think I don't know if you've studied positive psychology at all. Dr. Martin Seligman, he developed this field called positive psychology. And what he did was he tried to identify what are the components that allows somebody to live a full and meaningful life. And he came up with this acronym called PERMA, and it fits very closely with what you've already discovered yourself. So P is for positive emotions. Do things that give you positive emotions. E is for doing things that will make you feel engaged, that you are in flow. R is for relationships. M is for meaning, doing things that give you meaning in life. And the last one is doing things that give you a sense of achievement. So that's the A, so PERMA. So each of those kind of have this level of enough. So as long as you do all five of those things, that will help you to live a full and meaningful life. So that's something I would recommend you do. He's written a beautiful book called Flourish, and it shows the science behind what makes some people flourish in life despite many of the limiting starting conditions that they face versus others as not. And it's really about those five elements. So it fits very well with your own theory.
Okay. So for when you were, if you were to compare his and mine, what would you say are basically what's right about what I said and what's right about what he said?
Yeah, I think that there's a key thing. What they realized, you know, initially they didn't have the A part, which is the achievement part. And he started asking questions. Why do people have hobbies, play golf, play chess, etc.? Is that it's an important thing that we'd experience a sense of achievement. So we could be doing something, playing chess or tennis or whatever it is, or debating, etc., that is not meaningful, that doesn't contribute to our relationship, or but it's purely there for the sense of achievement. And it turns out that that is a key prerequisite for us to feel like we're living a full and meaningful life, is that we have at least one thing that will give us a sense of achievement. Now, if I can make that one thing related to my goal, that's even greater, right? So what we do now in our research lab is one of the benefits of having apps is you can actually count how many people are using your app to make decisions, right? So I know that on one of our apps, we have about 10,000 people that have downloaded the app. We know how many decisions is sitting in their decision library, and I can check where they are in the process. Are they step 1, 2, 3? So that's a way of, I get my sense of achievement in that part, because it's something I can measure and feel like I'm making progress or not.
So you would say that achievement and purpose are two separate things?
They're very different things. Absolutely, very different things. They can be related to the same thing if you can measure accurately if you are making progress towards your life goal or purpose. And that's something that I would highly recommend, is to say, if you have a life goal, how will you measure whether you are making meaningful progress to that? But sometimes these life goals have got very long time spans, right? Like Tony Robbins says, is we all overestimate what we can achieve in 1 or 2 years, but we underestimate what we can achieve in 10 or 20 years. So I need to do things that I can make, you know, feel a sense of achievement in the short term. It's an important part of our psyche, is being able to master things and feel like I'm making progress. It's like being able to ride a bicycle, right?
Yeah,
that makes a sense of achievement, both for the kid and for the parent that taught the kid how to do it, right? And that's an important part of happiness, is feeling that sense of achievement.
But you would say that achievement is related to happiness.
One of the components of happiness. You can measure it individually, and there's real evidence that even if you don't touch the other four, if you just improve your level of achievement, that gets people to score higher on their living a full and meaningful life.
Okay.
But I would highly recommend you and the listeners to go and read that book. It's called Flourish by Dr. Martin Seligman.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to check that out. Thank you, Alan, for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be on the show today. Do you have anything else you want to say to people? Anywhere you want people to go?
Yes, sure. One of the very simple techniques I developed many years ago is, I think one of our most limiting assumptions or beliefs is when we think that something is impossible. And I developed a very simple technique. It basically has just two steps. It says, pick a goal that you feel passionate about. Okay, so do you have the goal in your mind? And then I'm going to ask you, do you think it's possible to achieve this goal? If you say yes, I'm going to ask you to either increase the magnitude of the goal or to reduce the time. Both of those things can make the goal more ambitious, right? I want to help, you know, 1,000 people in the next 5 years. Okay, I want to help 10,000 people in 3 years. So keep on making the goal more and more ambitious until you say convincingly to yourself, now it's impossible. Right? So that's step one, is pick a goal that you are passionate about and keep on increasing your target until you say, and if you are working with a team, until everybody says, now it's impossible. And then you ask yourself the question for step two, which is, it's impossible unless. And what you'll see is you can't help it. Your brain immediately starts thinking about the conditions that can make the impossible possible. And if you write down those conditions and you build a plan, you can make the impossible possible. So I have a podcast series called Impossible Unless. And every episode is basically I pick a target that people generally think might be a very difficult target to achieve, even to the point that it might be impossible. And then I share with them the research that we've done and the field testing about what those unless conditions are.
So, sorry, could you say what the podcast name was again?
Impossible Unless with a question mark. And it basically it describes the two steps in this process. It's pick a target, keep on increasing the target until you say, now it's impossible. And as soon as you or somebody else says, now it's impossible, then you simply ask them, it's impossible to achieve this target unless?
Yeah. Is there a purpose for why you make people do this?
Yes, because the fact that I say that something is impossible typically would mean that I won't try it, right? So that's overcoming that limiting assumption or belief that I might have a life goal or dream, but I think it's impossible. And then people can say, why even try it? So that's, first of all, to expose there's an assumption that you think that something is impossible to do. That's the first opportunity. Bring it from the subconscious to the conscious mind. The second one is, okay, how do I overcome it? How do I find out what would make the impossible possible? And it turns out the simplest way of doing that is just to ask yourself, or if you have a team involved, to say it's impossible to achieve this unless. And the mind will immediately start thinking about those things, else it gets stuck, right? And you can listen to the first episode, I explained to you how I developed this method out of necessity. I was in this environment where I had to help somebody achieve a target that they thought was impossible. I asked them how they're going to do it, and they said, it's not fucking impossible. Now what do? Right? You have no domain knowledge to help them figure out some silver bullet. And the only thing that came to mind was I said to them, okay, it's impossible to do it unless. And I just let it hang there. And you could literally see their mind is now racing a million miles an hour, right? Because it's trying to find those conditions. And as soon as it finds it, you can share it to say it's impossible unless I can do the following. Like if you say somebody is terrified of public speaking, they say it's impossible. I can't be a public speaker unless, right? Can you see what happens to your mind? As soon as you ask them unless, it forces them to give you all the unless conditions. So you say, okay, now that you have the conditions, how can you make that possible?
Yeah. So I encourage everyone to go and listen to Alan's podcast, Impossible Unless. And yes. I'm definitely going to check it out. And thank you again, Alan. And I hope you enjoyed today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye, everyone.